From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Capturing the Friedmans, the new documentary about a father and son accused of sexually molesting children, and how those charges tore apart the family. The movie uses home videos the family made of their conversations and their fights. Capturing the Friedmans also features interviews with the detectives, lawyers, and judge involved with the case. It turns into a film about the subjective nature of memory and the elusive nature of truth. We'll meet the director, Andrew Jarecki. New Yorker film critic David Denby called this film both a meditation on perversion and truth and one of the most heartbreaking films ever made about an American family. Capturing the Friedmans, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham has ordered what he called an aggressive and far-reaching overhaul of security at the nation's three nuclear weapons laboratories. The move comes in response to recent lapses ranging from missing computers to reports of guards asleep on the job. GOP Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa told a House hearing today that security at the labs is lax and the nation's nuclear secrets are not safe. President Bush is pledging that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden will eventually be captured or killed as the U.S. and its allies pursue key terrorist figures worldwide.
Slowly but surely, we're dismantling the networks. We'll continue on the hunt. It doesn't matter how long it takes.
Mr. Bush was speaking after a meeting at Camp David with Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf, whom Mr. Bush credited with capturing more than 500 al-Qaeda and Taliban officials. In Iraq today, six British military policemen were killed and eight other British soldiers were wounded in two separate incidents. Iraqis have staged 25 attacks on U.S. and British troops in the past day alone. The BBC's Caroline Hawley has more.
The past few weeks have seen a steady spate of attacks on American forces, but until now, British troops in southern Iraq have faced very little trouble. They've had a different approach to their role as occupiers. American soldiers, for example, always wear flak jackets and helmets, while British troops in and around Basra mostly patrol without. But the areas they control are also very different. The south of Iraq, where British troops are based, is populated by Shiite Muslims, were oppressed by Saddam Hussein and were particularly glad to see him gone. The area where the Americans have been facing the most resistance is dominated by Sunni Muslims, among whom Saddam Hussein drew his support.
The BBC's Caroline Hawley in Baghdad. A Jordanian man who says he used to be a bodyguard for Osama bin Laden has gone on trial, accused of plotting grenade and gun attacks in German cities. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
German prosecutors say Shadi Abdallah was in charge of identifying targets and getting the weapons needed for a gun attack planned for an unidentified, crowded public place and a planned grenade attack near a Jewish or Israeli building. Neither attack happened. Abdallah was arrested more than a year ago. He's also charged with being a member of a terrorist organization. Prosecutors say the 26-year-old is part of Al-Tawid, a group the U.S. says has ties to Al-Qaeda. Abdallah allegedly has a close relationship with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is suspected of planning recent attacks in Jordan. The two allegedly met at an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan, where Abdallah spent more than a year. His trial in Dusseldorf is expected to run for several months. Emily Harris, NPR News, Berlin.
Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 37 points in heavy trading, but the Nasdaq was down 5 at 16.05. This is NPR News. The government of Sudan has reportedly filed a complaint stating that a ship seized by Greece over the weekend was carrying a legitimate cargo. The ship was packed with explosives and fuses destined for a company in Sudan. John Seropoulos reports from Athens.
The Greek merchant marine minister said the Baltic Star, seized on Sunday with 680 tons of explosives on board, had entered Greek waters illegally. He also pointed out the conspicuous lack of concern on the part of the Sudanese company allegedly purchasing the explosives for road construction. How can a journey which should have taken 4 days at most not begin to worry the contracting parties after 41 days at sea, especially considering the nature of the cargo, he asked. The Greek Coast Guard has removed the detonators from the ship to minimize any risk of explosion. The ship's seven crew members are charged with illegal explosives possession. They will appear in court on Wednesday. For NPR News, I'm John Psaropoulos in Athens.
A member of the board investigating the Space Shuttle Columbia breakup says it now seems increasingly certain that a piece of foam insulation that broke off Columbia's external fuel tank is what caused the disaster.
Those are issues that we have to be concerned with for future flights and certainly can't disregard, so we have no intention of disregarding them. But from what is the most probable cause, we believe that the foam is the most probable cause.
Roger Tetrault says the board's final report is expected to be done this summer. The chairman of the panel says NASA should be able to make the necessary changes and get the remaining shuttle fleet flying again within 6 to 9 months. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy, on the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about what is perhaps the most controversial film of the year and one of the most acclaimed, the documentary Capturing the Freedmans.
Well, this is private, so if you're not me, then you really shouldn't be watching this, because this is supposed to be a private situation between me and me. It's between me now and me in the future. So turn it off. Don't watch this. This is private.
That's just one of the home videos we see in Capturing the Freedmans. These private videos don't show anything salacious. They document a family coming apart. In 1987, Arnold Freedman, the father in the family and a retired award-winning schoolteacher, was arrested and accused of sexually molesting children in the computer classes he taught in his home. 18-year-old Jesse Freedman, the youngest of Arnold's three sons, was also accused of molesting the students. Even though they both maintained their innocence, they feared they would be convicted, so they pleaded guilty in the hopes of getting shorter sentences. Arnold Freedman committed suicide in prison. Jesse was released in 2001 after serving 13 years. Although Arnold Freedman said he never molested his students, he did secretly collect pedophile literature. Capturing the Freedmans documents how the family reacted to that discovery and to the criminal charges. In addition to seeing the Freedmans' home videos, we see interviews with the family and interviews with detectives, lawyers, and the judge involved in the case. No one seems to agree on what really happened. My guest is the film's director, Andrew Jarecki. It's his first film. He founded MoviePhone, which he sold to AOL in 1999 for $388 million. Capturing the Freedmans isn't the film Jarecki set out to make. He intended to make a documentary about the oldest Freedman's son, David, and his career as a popular clown at children's parties in New York. What was the turning point for you when you realized that the story, the way you were telling it, was only just a fraction of what the real story was, and that there was a much darker story underneath that?
Well, there's a moment in the film early on when you see David Freedman sitting on the steps of his boyhood home. And I had brought him there because I felt that the stories that he was telling me about his family were these kind of neatly packaged stories that didn't really go anywhere. And knowing what I know about families and how screwed up they often are, it seemed to me implausible. And I said to him, "Well, you know, why don't we go back to your house where you were a kid?" And he said, "No, we don't really need to do that." And I said, "No, let's do that." And so we went back, and I seat him on the steps of his boyhood home, and he gives me sort of the same routine for a while. And I said, "That's really it?" And he said, "Yeah, that's pretty much it. My father was a great guy, and my mother is crazy. And, you know, my brothers were wonderful." And I said, "When was the last time you were in your bedroom?" And he said, "Oh, it's been many, many years." So I went up and I knocked on the door, and there was a woman that owns the house now, and she let him go into his bedroom. And I stayed outside for the time that he was in his bedroom. And finally, by the time he came out, he was a little wobbly, a little emotional. And it was the first time I'd seen him like that. And he sat back down, and I said, "All right, is there anything else you want to tell me?" And he said, no, that's pretty much it, unless you want to hear about my mom's suicide attempt." And it was really the first moment of any kind of really deeply personal revelation. And I said, "Sure, well, let's talk about that." And I pushed him on that a little bit. And in the film, there's a moment when he says, "Well, there's a lot I could." And then he sort of pauses and he says, "Well, there's some things I don't want to talk about." And so it was really then that I knew that there was more to the story, although at the time I still didn't know what it was.
You know, I have to say, taking him to his bedroom, to the bedroom he grew up in, in a house that the family no longer lived in. Kind of a brilliant idea. Yeah, what? How did you think of that?
I thought, you know, I just thought that the closer I got him to his childhood physically, the mm-hmm. more likely he was going to be there emotionally.
So it wasn't David who told you the secrets of his family. You learned them someplace else. Did you learn them from the newspaper or from another member of the family?
Well, after I had that first conversation with David on the steps, I knew that I would need to do some digging on my own, and that he kept dropping these little breadcrumbs for me along the way. You know, he would say, well, you're a smart guy. You could figure it out. And so one of the things I wanted to do was to talk to his mother, partly because he was so hateful to his mother, and he would always say that my mother's an idiot and she's crazy and she's a child. And I thought, I didn't know that he was necessarily being fair to her. And I said to him at a certain point, well, you say so many awful things about your mother. I feel like I should go interview her. And he said, no, she would tell you crazy things and you can't believe anything she says. So, of course, that intrigued me. But I couldn't get to her, and I didn't want to get to her without his blessing in a way. So I waited. And then I found out that David had been on Candid Camera when he was a kid, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, it's like perfect, yeah.
And I knew that he always wanted to get a copy of it because they only had photographs of it that his father had taken of the television set. And I said, at one point I'd asked him about it, and he said it made him crazy that was the time he was the most famous in his life and he didn't have a copy of it because it was sort of before the age of VHS machines. And one day he called me up and he said, I know you want to talk to my mother, and I want a copy of that Candid Camera. So if you could use your filmmaker magic to get me a copy of the Candid Camera episode that I was on, then you could talk to my mother. And so we sort of had this deal making that went on during the course of making the film. And then eventually I did go see his mother. And we had this very interesting non-interview where she started to tell me things and then didn't. And I realized very early on that she had been sort of sworn to secrecy by David. And David said, you know, talk about the clown stuff, but that's it. But she says certain things in that first interview, which is in the film. There are portions of it that really grabbed me. Like at one point she says, well, I can't say too much about it. We were a family. And I remember when she said that to me, we were a family, that it just struck me as so sad because, you know, here's a woman who's in her 70s who obviously made her main mission in her life to build this family. And most of these people are still alive, but she's talking about the family in the past tense. So that really made me want to learn what had happened to the family.
So David didn't really tell you anything. His mother implied the terrible things that happened in the family, didn't tell you what those things were. So
right. How
did you find out?
Well, when I was at Elaine's house, I set up to interview her in the front room of her house. And she said, why don't you sit here and I'll come in when you're ready. So we set up and took about an hour. And then she came in about an hour later, and she said, all right, are you ready? And I said, yeah. And she said, you know, there's another room. I'm thinking maybe we'd be better off in this other room. So I take everything apart, and we set it up again in the dining room. It took another hour. Then she comes in at the end. She says, you know, I'm thinking maybe we should be in this other room. And I really got the sense that she was sort of physically bringing me deeper into her house. And she said, this is my office. Why don't we do it in here? And so she took me to this very tiny room in the back of the house. And we set up the camera in there, and she said, why don't you sit here at the desk, and I'll come back in a little while. And on the desk, there were a whole bunch of papers and bills and things all facing her direction. But where I was sitting, there was only one thing facing me, and that was a writing tablet. And on the tablet, in her handwriting, was written a letter, which, you know, I have to say, I thought it was sort of written to me because she put me right in front of it. In the end, I think it turned out to be, or she says it was a letter to the editor that she was thinking about writing. And it said, a person of faith, a deeply religious person, I was always brought up in the Jewish faith to believe that truth and justice were the most important things. Truth and justice were never a part of this case. And she goes on to say, you know, from the moment that the first accusations had been made against Jesse and his father, the community was in an uproar. And she sort of continues, and at that moment, I knew that there was a very public case, and I went on Nexus and did some basic research, and I found this huge story in Newsday, which described just in the most salacious, dark way, just these incredible odyssey of evil that had been described by the reporter in that story. And that certainly gave me enough information to go on.
So you suspected that there was a darker story than what you were finding out. You finally learned about the story through researching it in the newspapers. Then what? You went back to David Friedman and said, I know the real story, and that's the movie I want to make?
Yeah.
What was his reaction?
I didn't want to confront him with it with the cameras rolling, but I wanted to give him a chance to say it to me and to talk about it if he wanted to. So I was interviewing him normally, as we had many times before, and I turned off the camera and I asked everyone to leave. And he said, oh, what's going on? And I said, well, I want to let you know. You remember you said I was a smart guy, I could figure it out. Well, I figured it out. And, he sort of, his face fell for a second and he said, oh. And I said, I think that, you know that this is really the right film to make, and I think this film has to get made. And he said, he asked me a few questions about it, and he said, well, I know that I don't want this film to get made because it couldn't possibly be good for my career as a birthday party clown. And I said, yeah, but maybe it would be good for you in some other ways. I mean, this seems to have been a huge burden to you. And he said, you have no idea what a burden it's been. I'm going to entertain kids at a party, and simultaneously I'm getting a phone call from my brother who's just gotten beaten up in a state prison. He said, it's incredible. And I said, well, I want you to think about it. And we didn't do any interviewing for a long time after that. And I think he thought a lot about it. But during that time, everyone else in the family did want to be interviewed. And so I did go back and talk to Elaine after that. And that was when I got the main interview in the film of Elaine.
The people who did want to participate in the movie, do you think that they were hoping that a more complete version of their story would be told, a more sympathetic version?
Yeah, I mean, when I visited Jesse in jail, he said to me, I don't know enough to know whether I should trust you or not, but it doesn't matter because it can't get any worse for me.
Right.
I'm the lowest person in society no matter what, and when I get out of jail, I'm going to continue to be the lowest person in society. So my hope is that if you do the work, you will find out that this was incredibly miscarried and that I shouldn't be here at all. And I hope when I get out, there'll be a document. I don't even expect my prison term to end early at all. I just hope that there'll be a document so that when I get out, people won't say, oh, well, I read about you in the newspaper. That must be true.
Because you are reopening up this horrible, horribly painful story about convictions on child abuse, convictions that might have been wrong. And because everybody was still so emotionally ravaged by that experience, by making this movie, you risked really hurting people and getting them deeper into it and kind of totally retarding or ending the healing process. On the other hand, you took the chance, too, that it could help, that a truth that hadn't been revealed could be revealed, or complications that hadn't been seen could have been seen. But did you worry at all that you were taking on the responsibility for the mental health of these people? I mean, it's possible somebody could have even decided to take their life as a result of this being made public again. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I did think about that a lot. I mean, I certainly agonized over that. And I think, there's a balancing effect, because let's say I was able to show, as in some way the film does show, that some of these charges were completely baseless. Or that this prosecution was done in a way beyond shabby. The other side of it is that there are kids out there wandering around thinking that they have been horribly abused that maybe haven't. And that's something for many children to go carry that around for the rest of their lives. I mean, those people have had hundreds of conversations. Every time they've had a relationship, every time they've had a therapy session, they've had a discussion about that and what they believe happened or what they were told or what they remember or that they were in the computer class and they don't remember it. Whatever it is, that's damage. And I think for Jesse Friedman to have gone to jail for 13 years, that's tremendous damage. For the family to have been disrupted. So there was so much upside in terms of opening and letting air into this issue that I felt that if I could find the hope and positive in the story, I would. I should say that at a certain point, I felt I needed some counseling on it and some advice just to be able to talk to someone else who had been there before. And I sort of felt like I needed an ethics advisor. And so I went to see Dr. Coles at Harvard.
Robert Coles.
And you know, he's quite an interesting person because he's got this remarkable confluence of talents. He is the James Agee Professor of Social Ethics at Harvard. He's also an expert child psychologist, and he's also the editor of Double Take magazine, which is a documentary magazine. So he was right in the crosshairs of all these issues. And I went and I talked to him for most of a day, and I told him the story. And at the end, he very articulately said, "Yikes." And then, you know, after a little bit of discussion, he said, "Well, first of all, if you're worried about re-traumatizing people and about telling a story in a not in a humane way, if you're going to tell some salacious story, I wouldn't worry about it. Because if you were going to do that, you wouldn't be sitting here. And I would trust yourself. You're going to be humane. You're going to be kind to all the people that were involved in this. You're not going to make fun of anyone, and you're not going to misrepresent anyone. So first of all, don't worry about it." And that was kind of liberating, and I think that was true. And the second thing he said was, remember that you started out making a movie about David, and you're worried about how it could impact David's clown career, and that's a valid concern, and you should address that in some ways. But that's not what the film is about anymore. And so your constituents are no longer just David. Now Elaine is relying on you to tell her version of the story. And Jesse Friedman, who's in jail, is relying on you to give him some other purpose when he gets out of jail. And the kids who were allegedly abused in this computer class are relying on you. You know, it became something that went far beyond David.
My guest is Andrew Jarecki, author of the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Jarecki, director of the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Here's another home video from the film. Arnold is home for 6 weeks before going to prison. The family is sitting around the dining room table. David and his mother, Elaine, are fighting.
Why don't you try once to be supportive of me?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because we all started at the beginning of this thing,
Well, let's start from right now.
All right, let's start from right now. We're all starting brand new. We have a decision-making process on the table. It's clear. Great. All the past mistakes, they were mistakes. We're not going to hold them against anyone.
Great. Now we're starting afresh.
Okay.
I wanted you guys to call me.
All right, now we're going to do it. Starting now.
Seth, why don't you call me?
That's
a clip from Capturing the Friedmans, the new documentary. My guess is the director, Andrew Jarecki. I think most of us listening to this clip would think, God forbid my family fights were on video like this and that anyone in the world would see them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's potentially the most embarrassing, horrifying. I wouldn't even want to see them of my... you don't even want to see yourself in that situation. Just, it's over, fine.
Yeah.
So I think most of us who've seen the movie walk away thinking, why in the world did they videotape this kind of stuff?
Yeah. Well, you know, like many things in the film, there are two sides to that story. You know, the police would have you believe that the reason that the Friedmans videotaped everything is because they're so unhinged. They're just these sort of monstrous, crazy people, and they don't know the difference between video and real life, and the video is figured into all of their diabolical schemes. I don't find that to be the case at all. I think that David Friedman has said to me before, the reason I shot the videotape is because I knew my father was going to go to jail in 6 weeks, and he was home on house arrest. And I wanted to have a record of him for my children, for my grandchildren, and I didn't want them to have to read about their grandfather in the article that was written in Newsday or in some television broadcast. He was a real person. He was complex. He was a loving person. He was a good man in a lot of ways. Even if he did a number of bad things. And so, of course, I videotaped. My father, wouldn't you have? And as for the question of why he continued to videotape after it was, you know, it stopped just being a this is your life and let's talk about Arnold's childhood, I think David would say, we just had to have a record of what was going on. We couldn't even understand it. So we thought, well, we've got to commit this thing to something that we can look at later to try to interpret.
One of the things I kept thinking about watching the movie was, is the impulse to videotape your life like this and to videotape your family at the worst moment it has ever gone through and to videotape the fight surrounding that horrible moment, is that exhibitionistic in any way, even if you think no one else is going to see it? You know, and is there anything different about videotaping your life than writing about it in your diary? Everybody keeps a diary at some, or almost everybody keeps a diary at some point or another in their life.
Right.
And we usually lock it up or hide it in a drawer and hope that no one gets to see it. But, you know, a videotape seems like so much more public and so much more about watching yourself live through something.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's easier to think of it as either an exhibitionistic or narcissistic act because it's about watching yourself go through an experience.
Well, you know, first of all, I should say that they didn't just videotape it. They also audiotaped it because when the video camera couldn't be present, for example, the boys knew that the parents were arguing about these things. And the boys, in my view, didn't know how much the father was professing and claiming innocence and how much he was truly innocent because some of the charges would have been things that probably would have been difficult for anyone other than the father to know about. And so the boys, seeing where this was headed, would do things like audio tape their parents in their bedroom. So they had like a little Radio Shack, you know, audio recorder.
You mean like a hidden recorder?
Yeah, they would sort of put it next to the door of their parents' room to record what their parents were saying so that they could go listen to it. David did have a diary. So there was audio taping, there was videotaping, there was diary writing going on at the same time. David says at one point in the film, maybe I shot the videotape so I wouldn't have to remember it myself because I don't really remember it outside of the videotape. I at least understand, you know, from his perspective, why he felt like the trauma that was going on was so hard to absorb that in a way he had to put a camera between himself and it. But, you know, this was the way of this family. They had always had a camera. In this dinner that you're talking about, where the family's sitting around and having this incredible argument, to me, it was remarkable to see because the camera literally has a seat at the table. I mean, it's clear that two of the brothers have moved apart to enable the camera to be at the dinner table. And I think also that, you know, that they were videotaping so frequently that they just, you know, didn't turn it off. And as a result, everyone behaved totally normally around it.
Andrew Jarecki will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with film director Andrew Jarecki about his documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Then we'll hear from Susan Orlean, who wrote a profile in The New Yorker on David Friedman and his career as a clown before she knew that his father and brother had been imprisoned. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Jarecki, director of the new documentary Capturing the Friedmans. In 1987, Arnold Friedman and his then 18-year-old son, Jesse, were accused of sexually molesting children in the computer classes Arnold taught at their home in the suburb of Great Neck, New York. Although they both maintained their innocence, they feared they would be convicted, so they pleaded guilty in the hopes of getting shorter sentences. The film documents how the family fell apart. When we left off, we were talking about the home videos the family made of their conversations and their fights. So one of the reasons why they made these tapes is that they could have a record of what really happened. But what we learn from your film and from all the home videos is that everybody's totally contradictory of each other. And watching your movie, we really don't know what happened because the lawyer and his own client contradict each other about their own conversations. The mother and the sons contradict each other. The father and the sons. The two brothers contradict. Everybody contradicts each other.
Yeah.
It's the truth is so elusive in this. So, you know, I guess the things that were videotaped are kind of undeniable, but everything around it certainly is up for grabs. And even the interpretation of those home videos.
Well, there are moments
are
even
up to, you know, yeah, they're subjective.
Yeah, I mean, there are moments in the home videos when, David's at the table at one point and he says to someone, well, they're talking about a witness in the case, and he says, well, clearly he's lying because nothing happened. Did something happen, Dad? No, so nothing happened. He actually turns to his father and asks him whether his father has done anything to bring this on the family. His father doesn't answer, and David interprets it instantly as a no and doesn't even pause for the answer. So there are moments in the videotape where you say, ah, very interesting. So that tells me something about how the dynamic was going on in the family. There really never was a moment when those boys turned to their father and said, you know, do you have something to tell us? David later says in the film, well, you know, we begged him to tell us if something happened because how else had this all sort of come down on us? Well, they didn't beg him, and I think they might think that they did. I don't think they wanted to hear the answer, perhaps. But I would say that the same goes at least as much for the police because – and that's in a way potentially much more dangerous because the Friedmans may have been an easy target for this kind of thing because they are a family that split very easily around these issues. They had so many problems internally, just in terms of relating to each other. But when I first saw that detective, Fran Galasso, and first interviewed her, I was searching for somebody to believe. I was searching for somebody who's going to have a clear representation of what happened that I could consider authoritative. So she says to me early on in the film, well, the one thing you have to worry about, I know I worried about it all the time, is that just charging someone with this kind of a crime is enough to ruin their lives. So you want to be sure. So when you hear her say that, you think, oh, finally, all right, with all these conflicting stories and all this page turning, I finally have somebody who is articulate, intelligent, she's cautious. You know, she's not going to lead me down some path without being careful. So she's going to be my narrator. I'm going to trust her from now on when I'm watching this film. And then 5 minutes later in the film, she totally impeaches herself. And now you're back on your own, and the audience has to make the decision for themselves. So here you have a police department and a prosecuting side of a case where their grasp of reality is exactly as skewed as the Friedmans. I mean, the police were no more clear in their thoughts, perhaps a lot less clear in their thoughts than the Friedman family.
So one of the things you have to ask yourself watching this movie is, does everybody believe what they're saying? Are they lying, or are they just guilty of self-delusion? And where's that line between lying and just deluding yourself to the point where you really believe what you're saying, even though what you're saying isn't true? Did you think about that a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets to so many of the interviews in the film. There's an interview with that judge, for example. I mean, the judge is sort of such an interesting character because, you know, she is brought into the case early. She's friends with the chief detective, Fran Galasso. And it's clear, I think, where this case is going from the first minute. You know, as soon as they went into Arnold Friedman's house and they found a list of names of kids, immediately they handed it to the detectives and they said, go start talking to these kids. Well, one of the detectives that's interviewed says, we were given a list of alleged victims, and we went out to talk to them. Well, he was never given a list of alleged victims. He was given a list of computer students. Yet that small distinction, when it was handed to him and called a list of alleged victims, gave him a certain perspective going out to talk to these kids and a certain expectation of what he was going to find out. The judge says in this film, there was never a doubt in my mind as to their guilt. Now, for a sitting Supreme Court justice in Nassau County to say that there was no doubt in her mind, even though she's never seen a trial in this case, is a really frightening idea. And so going in, you find that everyone has such a strong agenda, right? A police detective who's well-intentioned goes in with a list of victims, right? A judge who is seemingly well-intentioned goes in with a preconceived notion, so much so that in this case she tells the district attorney, who tells Jesse's lawyer, she intends to give him consecutive sentencing. In other words, if out of the hundreds of charges he's been accused of, he's only convicted on three charges that carry a 15-year term, this 18-year-old kid is going to go to jail for 45 years. So when people go in with this tremendous preconception, the truth is altered when they start to speak. The moment they start to speak, it's sort of a translation, and it's a version that they bring their own perspective to.
In the Friedman family, the family seems to be ganging up against Elaine Friedman, the mother and wife. And watching the movie, the only evidence you have for why they would be so angry with her is that she suggested, based on what the lawyers were saying, that the father and the son should plead guilty in the hopes that they get lesser sentences.
Right.
And that strategy didn't work out real well for either of them. But I keep thinking, like, there must be a missing link somewhere. There must be something else in the family that explains the degree of anger and contempt the people in the family had for her. And I'm wondering, is there something left out that helps explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Certainly after working on this film for 3 years and reviewing what I think is every piece of known home video material and audio material and every therapy session, they recorded the therapy sessions with the family therapist. It seems to me that I've seen it. I mean, I've seen the material that there is to be seen. It's possible. I mean, I think that the feeling of a family who feels quite innocent, and if you see the film, I think there's a very good argument to be made for the idea that they may not be guilty of any of the charges that they were ultimately convicted of. In that light, it's easy to understand the indignance and the incredible anger and fear that they were feeling. And I think that this feeling that they needed someone to blame made it easy for the boys to blame the mother. You know, I've seen it in my family. You know, my brothers and I like to sort of give my mother a hard time. I imagine, you know, sometimes we and my father used to joke around at my mother's expense. And that seemed to me very primal, you know what I mean? Like, it's as if we work on the female in the family as a way of sort of seeing how we're going to relate to females when we grow up, or how we're going to become dominant and controlling. And so there's a certain caveman mentality to that. And I think when you add to that this incredible pressure from the outside, it refocused the energy against Elaine.
My guest is Andrew Jarecki, director of the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Jarecki, director of the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Making this movie in which everybody, and I've only touched the surface of all the contradictions in testimony, in what the family says about each other, and what the cops say, the detectives say, the judge says, it's just loaded with contradictions. Did you lose whatever faith you had in memory, the accuracy of memory, and the accuracy of first-person narrative, the accuracy in what people tell you about themselves and the life that they have led?
Well, I think it's clear, certainly, and was more and more clear to me during the film, that people's memories are incredibly malleable and change, and that, in fact, you know, we talk about a memory bank, like we put our memories somewhere and they stay static. But the reality, I think, is that memories are just these electrochemical impulses. You put them in the memory bank and they're bubbling away, and that everything you do in your life will influence them, you know. And we see it every day. People say, oh, yeah, well, I graduated from Harvard University. And then you find out that actually they kind of took a summer course from the business school. And then you say, well, how did they get there? And the answer is, if you confront the person, they don't generally say, you're right, you found me out. Usually they say, well, no, I kind of did. And I think there's that sense that our memories evolve over time to suit our needs, and that you can't trust a memory to be just this static thing that you can trust.
The person who seems to have the most difficult time accepting the fact that Arnold Friedman, the father in the family, actually did do something wrong, even if he was innocent of all the charges. He had a history of not only reading pedophilia material, but he had
had contact with kids.
He confessed having contact with kids, and he actually wrote something about himself in which he said, in my early 40s, during the summer, I did, quote, go over the line and did have sexually arousing contact with two boys short of sodomy. Now, you talk about that with David. And I want to play what David responds to hearing this statement that his father wrote.
It's one sentence. So what does that mean? What do you know what that sentence means? I don't even know what that sentence means. I sexually aroused? What the is he talking about? Maybe he put his arm around the kid. Maybe he was took him in the sailboat and he found that sexually arousing. Maybe he was leaning against a tree. That's called sexually arousing contact. If you're sexually aroused while you lean against a tree. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that sentence means.
Okay, that's David Friedman in a clip from the movie Capturing the Friedmans. My guess is the director, Andrew Jarecki. Okay, so David was kind of in denial in his ability to accept that even if his father was innocent of the charges in court, that his father did have sexual contact with children. When David finally saw your movie, did he change his mind at all about his father's life or about the truth, you know, the truth of his father's experience as a pedophile?
Well, I think when David first saw the film, I don't know how much he absorbed in that first viewing. I showed it to him. He was in a screening room in New York, and he got up during the titles and he left. And I waited a couple days before I called him. And when I called him, he just immediately asked me a number of specific detailed questions, and then he said, I want to see it again. And then over the course of seeing it now 10 or 12 different times and trying to absorb it, I think David has come to some different realizations. For one thing, I think he's seen that an audience seeing the film is able to discern some gray area, that if we accept that his father was a pedophile, that doesn't automatically mean that he went to jail properly, that his brother should have gone to jail, that the family should have been destroyed over it. It's possible for us to understand that Arnold had some problems, but he was, in a way, a good man also. And David loves his father so much, it's hard for him to accept any version that doesn't include his father also being a father to him.
Are you still keeping your opinion to yourself about the guilt or innocence of Jesse Friedman and his father, Arnold Friedman?
Well, I think it's important for people to see the film to reach their own conclusion about it. And I think people do reach conclusions quite quickly after the film. So I felt like my job was to bring the information forward. So many people in the film are willing to express themselves and give you detailed stories about things that occurred when they were not present, and I wasn't there. But what I will say is that I never ran into a situation in which Jesse Friedman told me something that later turned out not to be true. And that was not the case with almost anyone else in the film. His lawyer, Peter Panero, told me things that weren't true. And the judge told me things that weren't true, and the police told me things that weren't true. And not only was Jesse very forthcoming, but he would call me from prison in these little sort of heartbreaking 15-minute phone calls before the machine cuts you off. And he would say, well, what are you finding out? Who else can you talk to? See more people. What about the computer students? Do more work. So he was never afraid of what I was going to find out. He was always aggressively trying to get me to learn more, and I gave that a lot of value.
So now he's living, he's out of jail, and he's living the life of the convicted child molester.
Yeah. Well, Jesse has a very tough time. You know, when you get out of jail on crimes like this, you have to go back in front of the original judge. So this judge, who was very tough on him the first time, has to decide if you're a level one, a level two, or a level three sex offender. So she made him a level three, which is a violent sexual predator. So now he has to wear an electronic monitoring device around his ankle all the time. He can't leave his house after 7 o'clock at night. He can't go to Central Park. He can't live in a building where there are children. So, of course, the parole board approved a building that he had found to live in. And then after he moved in, a couple weeks later, they sent a letter to the board of the building saying, we just want to inform you that there's a violent sexual predator living in 7G. So then he was evicted and he had to live in a shelter. So, you know, he's had a very, very tough time. And I think that'll go on for many years to come. You know, you don't get out of this kind of situation once you're in it. And his hope, I think, is that some of the attention that this film will bring to his case may bring enough people forward to warrant a kind of analysis. Although, you know, he won't get his years in prison back, he may be able to get his parole restrictions relieved in some way.
Earlier in our interview, you said that you knew, you implied that you know a lot about families and you know how how screwed up families can be and what fights in families can be like. And I was wondering, like, how much you identified with what was going on in this family, with the kind of not only battles between them, but the battles for truth between them about, you know, like, what's the truth? What really happened?
Well, I think that's, I mean, I think anybody that has a family, and certainly I'm included in that, has a sense that, you know, there are certain platitudes and there's a certain kind of friendliness that exists in a family. But that in a way underneath that, there are always doubts and feelings of whether people are doing right by each other. And often in a family, you get a character like the father who sort of creates a lot of little fires and blows up little bombs in the family all over the place. And then he just sort of sits back at the dinner table and watches everybody else argue about them. You know, and I've seen that in my family. I've seen it in lots of families. And certainly Arnold was in that situation.
My guest is Andrew Jarecki, author of the documentary Capturing the Freedmans. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Jarecki, director of the documentary Capturing the Freedmans. One of the big contradictions where you're wondering what's true and what's not, when the son, Jesse Friedman, is accused of molesting children, he cops a plea and he pleads guilty. But what he says is that his father incested him and that that's what screwed him up. Now, Jesse says to you that his lawyer told him to say that in the hopes of getting a sympathetic treatment from the judge. His lawyer tells you, no, this is what Jesse told him. Jesse confessed this to him. The lawyer says, I would never suggest anything like that if it weren't true. And, of course, we're left with who to believe. How do you juggle that in your mind?
Well, I mean, I pushed Jesse's lawyer, Peter Panero, very hard on that because the premise here is that a lawyer can't take his client in to the judge and plead guilty unless he has been told by his client that he's guilty. And that if the lawyer doesn't believe that the client is guilty, he really shouldn't plead him guilty, because at the essence of the justice system, we hope justice is done. We don't hope deals are made. The reality is that deals are made every day. Deals are made in every case. And so when I pushed Peter on this, I would say to him, so you felt that Jesse was innocent? Oh, yes, I always thought he was innocent. So then there was this big moment when you decided that he wasn't innocent. Well, he told me he was guilty. And I said, did that change your mind? And he said, well, he told me he was. And I said, how did he tell you? And he said, he told me, Peter, I can admit it. And I said, is that the same thing as Peter, I did it? And Peter thought for a minute and he said, well, I wouldn't have pled him guilty if he hadn't told me he was guilty. And he wouldn't go any further than that. We've established that he was afraid he would be disbarred if he took his client in and pled him guilty, even if he thought he wasn't. He's in a film. He's not going to say any more than he said. And that's one of the interesting things about it, is you feel like, well, if you have all the film in the world and all the time in the world, ultimately you'll find the truth. But actually, some people won't give you any more truth than that.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Andrew Jarecki directed the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. In 1994, 7 years after Arnold and Jesse Friedman pleaded guilty to sexually abusing Arnold's computer students, Susan Orlean wrote a New Yorker profile of the oldest Friedman son, David, and his career as a popular clown at children's parties in New York. Orlean is best known as the author of The Orchid Thief, which was the basis of the recent film adaptation. When Orlean profiled David Friedman, she was unaware that his brother and father had been imprisoned after pleading guilty to molesting children. We asked Orlean to talk with us about how she felt when she learned about the family history, and if she thinks about how the parents who hired David after reading her profile reacted when they found out.
Definitely thinking about it. It's the nature of making public someone's life is so complex, and it's so fraught with responsibility and responsibilities that as a writer you're not even always aware of the responsibilities. In this case, first of all, I think it's you have to separate the fact of David from his father and his brother, no matter what. Just whatever they did or didn't do, David is a separate person. There was never any implication in anything, and certainly you sit through the movie and there's no notion whatsoever that he had anything inappropriate to do with these kids. But if I were a parent and I heard that the clown I was going to hire had a family history like that, I probably wouldn't hire him. And that's just natural. It's there's a discomfort that would come out of it. If the father were a murderer, it would even be different from being a pedophile, because you're talking about kids. There's so much that comes with writing about people or exposing people to the public eye. When I was doing a profile years ago of someone who was in a religious position of stature in his community, and he grew to feel very comfortable with me. And then one day he said to me, do you want to come meet my mistress? And I thought, well, I really don't know what to do. Part of me was thinking, well, this is great for my story. I mean, here this guy is standing in his community as somebody who's of some position in a religious, fairly conservative community, and he's introducing me to his mistress. You know, this was overwhelming. I didn't know what to do. Did I want to have his wife read in the New Yorker story about him that he was having an affair? I didn't know if I really felt that I could put myself in that position morally. I mean, no matter what, as a writer, you still have to be a moral person and make decisions. It would have been good for the story. It would have added an element that would have been really interesting. I couldn't do it. If I had heard that David Friedman's father was a pedophile, you know, to return to that, what would I have done?
What would you have done? Do you think you would have written the story?
Yes. I would have written the story, and I would have folded it in with a great deal of delicacy, because I don't think it's fair to imply that he, I mean, it's very much in the American tradition that you don't hold someone responsible for acts committed by members of their family. Would it have affected his business? Probably. Except I think, I don't know, I guess this is the great question in being a writer and your moral obligations to your subjects and the fundamental inability to ever know the truth and your need to kind of acknowledge that in your writing.
Susan Orlean writes profiles for The New Yorker and is the author of the book The Orchid Thief. We'll hear more of our interview later this week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toms of Maine, maker of natural care products and creator of the Rivers Awareness Program to preserve the nation's waterways. Information at participating stores or tomsofmaine.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He just returned from Iraq, where he likes to say he was looking for weapons of mass destruction. Several of his columns have been devoted to the claims of intelligence agents who told him the Bush administration pressured intelligence agencies to exaggerate the Iraqi threat. Join us for the next Fresh Air.